So we have been going through the kind of the major movements through the 19th century of the church. We've looked at Roman Catholicism. We've looked at the major developments in Europe and England. And we last time looked at the major developments happening in 19th century America. We saw all of the things that were happening there. But I wanted to save orthodoxy for last, not only because it was very essential into understanding some of the major things that happened that launched us into the big events of the 20th century, but also because beginning tonight, we're going to start wrapping things up. This will be the last time as far as a full focused lecture on orthodoxy goes. We're going to cover Russian and Eastern Orthodoxy from the 19th to the 21st century tonight, to the present day. And so we're going to cover that, some very important things. And like all of church history, it's so radically intermingled with world history. To know church history is to know world history, especially for the last 2,500 years, give or take. And we could say further, depending on how far you want to go. So I want to begin tonight by looking at the branch of orthodoxy that really has been the most central to orthodoxy in the past two centuries. And that is Russian Orthodoxy. Russian Orthodoxy has been really the staple to where things have happened within the Orthodox Church, primarily because the other parts of the Eastern Orthodox Church have spent much of their time for the past almost millennia underneath the reign and rule of Muslim empires and Muslim nations. And so they haven't been able to thrive and grow the way that the Russian Orthodox Church has been. So we're going to begin there, and we're going to spend most of our time looking at that, but we will close at the end by looking at how all of Orthodoxy has flourished up until today. We want to begin by looking at the Russian Empire and the Russian Church. Throughout the 19th century of Russia, and that's 1800 to 1899, the Tsars were the ones who ruled Russia. That was kind of their king. And they were known as the Tsars. And the Tsars belonged to what is known as the Romanov dynasty. They were the Romanovs. And what made these 19th century Tsars so powerful and so important to the Russian and to Russian history is the 19th century Tsars of Russia were by far the most aggressive of any of the Tsars before them. They gained massive amounts of territory and land, and with that, the people groups that belonged to those lands during the 19th century. In 1809, Finland came under Russian jurisdiction. In 1815, Poland was forced to participate in union with Russia. The Czech and Turks eventually came under Russian rule. And so Russia is growing more and more and more. And not only were they able to conquer many of these territories, but they also were able to create within this kind of cultural sentiment that they called the Pan-Slav movement. And the idea was to take all of the Slavic ethnic groups throughout Europe and to say, we are your homeland. Come here and we will create a united Slavic people. And through that, many of the Slavic groups throughout Europe began to migrate to Russia, believing that going there, they would kind of have their own beautiful, powerful nation of Slavic identity. And so many came from Central Europe, from the Balkans, and throughout other parts of Russia, began to all come together and unite into Russia. Now, many Western powers at first buddied with Russia because one thing that Russia was doing very well where most of the other Western powers weren't is that the Russians were actually able to overthrow much of the Turkish powers. They were able to kind of keep Islam at bay, whereas the vast majority of the Western powers weren't able to do that. And so large portions of Greece and other places like that had come under Islamic control at this point, whereas Russia was able to pretty much keep it out of bay and to continue expand its area further. However, even though the Western powers buddied with Russia because they were able to keep the power of the Turks down, they always did so with the kind of choosing of the lesser of evil mentality. Because what they saw in the Tsars was something very dangerous. They saw men who had powerful influence almost over the entirety of all the Balkan states and Central Europe, extending all the way into Asia as well. This seemed like a massive force, and it worried the vast majority of the Western powers. This ultimately would lead to a war breaking out, and that war is known as the Crimean War. It took place in 1853 to 1856, where England, France, and Sardinia actually joined up with the Ottoman Turks to fight against Russia. And ultimately, the Western powers, coupled with the Ottoman Turks, would win, and that would be a huge blow to Russia. Russian troops would eventually get to the gates of Constantinople, and this caused some of the Western diplomats to panic, and they rushed this kind of document called the Treaty of Berlin. But this ultimately led to greater problems that would lead to World War I and World War II, with kind of strategizing powers and who was going to be on what side and creating allies and things like this. All of these things are starting to create this very unsettling soup of chaos and conflict that's going to boil over into World War I, which is interesting because Russia won't participate in World War I because they will be fighting a civil war during that period. And we'll look at that here in a moment. For a time, the Russian Empire stretched across seemingly endless tracts of land. At this point in the mid-19th century, Russia stretched from Poland west all the way to Alaska. So from it included people from Russia, it included Ukrainians, it included Belarusians, Poles, and many other ethnic groups. So it was the most diverse nation in the world at this point in the 19th century. It looked like Russia was going to be the world's greatest superpower. And it really looked like that was going to be the case. But before we go any further about Russia, I, like always, need to get a little Alaskan history in here with this. Why not, you know? In 1741, a Danish man named Vitus Bering, he was a member of the Russian Navy, he began to discover to see if Asia actually linked to North America. He was looking for this kind of land bridge, this idea that was there a way where Asia and America linked. And so he began looking through this in an area that is long known as the Bering Strait, looked through these areas, and ultimately, on July 26th, some of his crew members looked out and they started to observe some lower slopes, which they thought were covered with trees. And they thought, this is America. This is North America. So to celebrate the finding of North America, they decided to celebrate with a Russian Orthodox liturgy right there in their ship. And they did this in America aboard a ship in a bay known as Sitka Bay in Alaska. This was the first Orthodox service in America ever, and it happened on a ship in the middle of Sitka Bay. Just a little interesting thing there. Monks soon began to pour into Sitka and other parts of Alaska, bringing the Russian Orthodox faith, and Russian Orthodox missionaries pretty much for the next 40 years dominated the Alaskan mission. They created the vast majority of missions among Alaskan natives. And there are places today, there are villages today, that they will not allow Protestants to go into because of the Russian Orthodox hold on those places. So if we were to go in and try to do, even if we were trying to do like a service mission, we still would not be allowed to go in there. Or we would meet a very angry priest who would ask us, maybe kindly, to leave from there. On March 30th, 1867, the Russian government sold Alaska to the U.S. for a whopping $7.2 million, to which brought much criticism. It was known as Seward's Folly, or Seward's Icebox, who the Secretary of State at the time was William Seward, an American. Everybody thought, what is this idiot doing? So all of these political cartoons began to come out. Trust me, this was social media back in the day, man. This was Twitter, and they made just as much fun of their politicians as we do today. Here's a picture of him putting salve on the head of then-President Andrew Johnson. And if you read, you probably can't read it there, but on the salve bomb it says, Russian salve. And so they thought this was a huge mistake. why in the world do we want this barren, cold wasteland up north? You know, why would we go and spend money on that when we're still trying to focus on getting our own territories in line? The purchase, however, was far from foolish. As the Americans bought Alaska for a measly 2.2 cents per acre. That's how much Alaska was purchased by. When you think about that, that's an incredible purchase. Absolutely brilliant. And obviously, we as Alaskans, they are very thankful that William Seward pushed that. But what's interesting is though the first Russian Orthodox liturgy took place in Alaska, the first Russian Orthodox church was actually built in California. They built monasteries here, but they actually never built churches. And part of that reason was because of ethnic issues with Alaska Natives. There was a lot of issues of whether or not Alaska Natives should be allowed to attend their churches and things like that. So there was a lot of issues with ethnic and racial tension there that occurred for a while. They believed they could get the gospel, but there was a lot of issues over should they be allowed in sacred worship. And so there was a big tension there for many years amongst the Russian Orthodox until a little bit later on in the 19th century. Back to the stars of Russia. The primary star of Russia at this point was Tsar Nicholas I, and he prosecuted absolutely ruthless policies in order to try to control the state. And he saw the Russian Orthodox Church as a pillar to progress his authoritarian policies. He saw the church as the perfect way to control people. And so what he did, actually very interesting, is he created a model based upon Lutheran Germany, which is built upon a state church, where the king of Germany was the king of the church, the leader over the church. And he saw that model and said, hey, I like that idea. And it allowed him to utilize the church to kind of advance some of his authoritarian policies. One Russian critic of the church during that time wrote the following. He said, quote, "The church served as the bulwark of the whip and the handmaid of despotism," end quote. There's probably some who feel that way today as well regarding some certain ideologies. In 1855, his son, Alexander II, was coronated as Tsar. And with his coronation, it was a little bit different. He wasn't near as cruel as his dad. And he came in with this idea, we are going to establish Russian beauty once more. So if you've gone to Moscow, or if you've seen pictures of Moscow or St. Petersburg, Russia, you see the giant buildings with the giant domes on top. They're very colorful. Russian Orthodox, you usually see them, they wear a very beautiful bonnet. It's got glitter in it. It's very, it's much more aesthetic to the eye. And Russian Orthodoxy has always been that way. If you go back to some of our other lectures, we went in more detail of why that was. But it was always about kind of this Russian aesthetic. And Alexander wanted to kind of create this kingdom back again on this very beautiful picture of a mighty Russia. However, when Russia was defeated in the Crimean War, this led to a great issue. What once was seen as this growing superpower, this vast empire, all of a sudden was shown to have an Achilles heel. For how large of a territory it was, Russia had a rather weak army. And that was its greatest vulnerability. It was unable, its army was unable to control that amount of land and was stretched so thin that it was easily overcome by the stronger forces and the more industrialized forces of England, France, and the Ottoman Empire. And that would be ultimately the reason why, once it broke away and Hitler turned on the Russians in World War II, why they did pretty quick work against the Russians in that regard until the United States entered into the Western Front. Alexander, after people began to grow more and more upset over the loss of the Crimean War, went from being this idea of kind of this romantic leader of leading with nobility and aestheticism, immediately turned back to his father's policies and began becoming another cruel autocrat. What's interesting, though he was a cruel autocrat, he was also a radical social reformer, which that almost seems like an oxymoron. How does that go together? But for instance, 2 years prior to Abraham Lincoln giving the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, Alexander gave a proclamation in 1861 that freed every enslaved serf in Russia. Prior to this, there were slaves, and they were serfs. They were known as serfs there in Russia, and he freed every one of them. And yet, he would go to ruling over them with a very iron fist and hand. And so, it's a really interesting dynamic there that it happens with Alexander. Many people wanted to kill Alexander. He eluded many assassination attempts, except in 1881. Finally, this group known as the People's Will, which that ought to scare you, any group that calls itself the People's Will, especially what we see today, was a revolutionary sect, and they actually threw two bombs and set off two bombs, which ultimately the last one terminally wounded the Tsar, killing him. His son Alexander III took his father's throne and immediately undid many of his father's reforms because he said, "You want to kill my dad who's trying to do good things? Well, we'll just be evil. We will just destroy you and keep you under a hand of totalitarianism." And that's what happened. Alexander becomes extremely totalitarian. And one of the places that he directs his thrust, which will become a very common theme amongst European nation states during the 19th century and even early into the 20th century, is he directs the blunt of his arrow really towards Jews. Jews become the bad guys. Jews become kind of the easy scapegoat to start turning against. And so this idea of anti-Semitism really becomes central to the planning of Alexander III. And what happens is the Jews then get blamed for the assassination of his father, Alexander II. And so from 1881 to 1884, these new things called pogroms began to happen in Russia. And these pogroms were basically violent anti-Jewish riots that would go into these Jewish areas and just wreak havoc, killing people. They were very brutal, very deadly, very just nasty in so many ways. And these pogroms really set the stage for what would later happen and find its perfect fulfillment in Hitler's Germany. This was all leading those steps of a growing anti-Jewish sentiment that caused so many during this period to immigrate to America, which is why we had a booming Jewish population in the late 19th and early 20th century. What made this even worse was the fact that this wasn't just merely kind of the people's rising up to try and find someone to blame, but the government itself, anytime, and guys, hear me this is just history 101. Anytime the government sees something that can make people angry, they will use that to distract the anger from the ones it should be put on. That's something that the government does. They realize that it can get the masses' attention off of them being put the blame on, they will utilize it. And that's what the government did. They took this anti-Jewish sentiment and they ran with it, creating multiple anti-Jewish legislations. And this caused a horrific purging of Jews. Jews were not allowed in the major cities of Russia. Moscow, St. Petersburg, and so many others purged Jews from there. And they justified this the same way that Hitler would justify it later on, by saying, "Oh yeah, well, the Jews crucified Jesus, so we can do whatever we want to them. We can treat them however we like." I guess they did not read the part where Jesus asked the Lord to forgive the Jews on Calvary. And even Stephen, who asked the Lord to forgive them. But nevertheless, they pushed beyond that, and it just is a reason to use an excuse, and it provides them a biblical justification to do so. With this growing persecution, however, many Jews began to be attracted to these new ideas, the most important of them being this idea called Zionism. The idea, as Jews began to grow, was that we are going through the persecutions that were seen in Isaiah, and Ezekiel, and Daniel. And we know that the Messiah is going to come and restore us. We're waiting for that. And so, the only way that He's going to do that is for us to get to Palestine. We've got to get back to Palestine because that's where the Messiah is going to come. Now, they very much still rejected Jesus as the Messiah, and that's always been their great folly. But the idea is we need to go and usher in the coming of the Messiah. And how do we do that? We got to get back to Zion. We got to get back to Palestine. We got to get back to the Temple Mount. And so this becomes the growing sentiment amongst Jewish people of getting back to Zion. And it is also the way in which many of these Jewish groups begin lobbying England and America. This is what we need to have happen. And so the idea of them having sovereignty over the land of Palestine, things like that, all begin flowing out of these ideas of Zionism and will lead to the Jewish establishment of the modern secular state of Israel in 1946. And that's all leading to that, and some of the major things that developed that. We talked about how not only did it lead to Zionism, but it led to massive immigration. And the largest area where Jews immigrated to into America was New York City. There's still actually very large Jewish populations there today. We now, kind of with that background and that context of everything that's happening there in Russia, we need to talk about kind of what's happening in the church world. What's going on in church life in Russia? Now, the life of the Russian church in the 19th, 20th century was actually really nothing very vibrant. Most of them were just trying to flee persecution. The repressive Tsarist regimes made it very hard. And what these regimes did that made it so hard for the church to flourish was they used intellectual censoring. They did not allow things to be published. They did not allow people to have freedom of speech. They didn't allow church to publish documents outside of the building. So they utilized intellectual censorship in order to stifle the church. Censorship is always, another again, been a tool of governments to keep things from happening and movements that go against what their desires are to stop them. They not only used censorship, they did forced exiles, they utilized torture and death in order to keep people in line. Many priests were tortured during this period. More than 90% of Russian Orthodox bishops between 1721 and 1970 came from a privileged clerical class. And their autocratic control of the church governments and positions and their intrusive policies caused those priests to really have a major disdainment from the common person. The common person coming to liturgy on the Lord's Day and he's coming and looking at a priest who cannot empathize with them in any way, who cannot sympathize with them in any way, who is very noble, who has come from a top-level family, and they felt no representation in their church body. They were seen as lesser than by the very men who were called to shepherd them. And this created a further greater disdainment against the Orthodox clergy. Many priests began to decry that the bishops were not treating them like, because this is the issue, the more further you went up in the hierarchy of the church, the more nobility came with that. And so priests actually began to get a little bit of power and were able to come up from some of these lower classes, but the bishops had to be from the noble class. And so you had noble class bishops treating kind of working lower class priests like slaves. They treated them like garbage. And this was all creating this growing unrest and class division that was going to lead into a horrific revolution just down the road. Laity were restricted from freedoms of worship and intellectual freedom. And the church, thus at the hand of Tsars, did nothing and did very little to create disciples of Christ, but rather created atheists who hated him. This is the great issue with the Russian church during this time, was because of the repressive regimes of the Tsars and because of the way in which class and money and kind of a hierarchical caste system had fallen into the church, it actually did more to create atheists than it did disciples. And that should warn us all about why and how we do church matters. It really matters. And so just some words. But it is important that we don't just say it was all negative. This was a time where many seminaries and theological academies were kind of raised up to try and create a number of priests to get to this growing vast territory that was being reached by these kind of czars attaining these new lands. But what also came with this was something we talked about in some previous lectures, the idea of hesychasm. Which really centered on holy, ascetic, and joyful living. And like everything that happens, there's you can have two approaches when it comes to how you as a church approach a persecuting government. You can do option A, and that is take that persecuting government head on. Option B, flee and become monks and just abandon yourself from civil affairs in the world. That's really the only two options. Now, some people try to balance both, but at the end of the day, you're going to side one or the other. And so the vast majority of Russians going, we don't want to get our heads cut off, we don't want to be tortured, and things like that. They chose to flee into monasteries and kind of get away. And so the monkish movement, the monastic movement, once again revised in the Russian church. Saint Innocent at this time was named the Bishop of Alaska. He was the first Bishop of Alaska, and he was vital doing missionary work here. Missionaries also spread into Siberia and Muslim groups as well. Siberia was primarily populated by nomadic tribal indigenous groups who all came through Christ because of this. A very important period of mission work as well. And in those outer regions of the realm of Russia, it was obviously a lot safer. The more you got to the larger cities, the more dangerous it was. And once again, we could say more about that as well. It was also during this time that two Russian writers began to analyze the situation that they were facing in Russia. And through their analysis, they began to document in some of the greatest writings we have today a vast number of problems that confront the human condition. These are two of my favorite writers, even though I disagree with them a lot of things. Some of my favorite writers, and that is Fyodor Dostoevsky and Leo Tolstoy. Very important during this period. Dostoevsky's notable works include Notes from the Underground, Crime and Punishment, The Idiot, The Brothers Karamazov, and Tolstoy's works, obviously, War and Peace and Anna Karenina. These are all very important works. If you haven't read them, you should read them. You should read the classics before they all get burnt or something. Who knows, you know? But you should read them, and so download them on your Kindle now. But these great writers did what all great writers do. They were able to paint panoramic scenes of all of the major issues that were happening in Russia. From bloody battles to the festive Russian dances and the aestheticism of the Russian church. And they were able to do something that really made readers captivated, and that was to create these incredible, finely brushed psychological portraits of unforgettable characters. They were able to take ideologies and worldviews of their day and create characters that reflected those ideas. They were able to create characters of what nihilism looks like. They were able to create worldviews of what a Christian worldview looks like, of what a Marxist worldview looks like. They were able to take people and show you what those things actually look like when you live them out and what they look like. And that's what made them so masterful. These two men probe deeply into the major problems we all face. The origin of evil, disease and suffering, intense feelings of remorse and guilt, the inevitability of death, broken relationships, and much more. All of these things which plague the human conscience and the human condition were so elegantly and beautifully painted by these two writers. Tolstoy, for example, was shaken by the horrors and havoc of the Crimean War, which he fought in. And this is where War and Peace come from, was his experience from fighting in the Crimean Wars. And due to the savagery of war, Tolstoy came to this conclusion and asked this question: how can Christian nations choose war as a means of settling their differences with each other? That was his question. How can Christian nations make war? He's not saying there wasn't a place for war. He was simply asking, how can two professing Christian nations see war as the final option when they know the horrors and savagery that it comes with it? Tolstoy himself was absolutely haunted by the fear of his own death. And I would argue that much of what he understood about Russian Orthodoxy and what Russian Orthodoxy teaches left him with a lack of assurance and a complete fear of death. He made two trips to a Russian Orthodoxy to meet with a monk in order to try and receive some kind of solace for this great, horrifying fear that he had for death. But nevertheless, when he left, he actually said, I felt emptier than when I was when I came there. I felt more guilty, more wicked, and more evil. I felt as if everything they told me to do, I had already tried and realized how often I fail. And he said, to quote, when I realized the works they gave me and how I could not keep them, I just wanted to take my life. This is, to me, the great dangers of any works-based system. Because any person who has come to the end of themselves realizes, I can't do it on my own. I radically need God's grace. And I need His work to work on my behalf. And to me, that's the beauty of the doctrine of the perseverance of the saints. The doctrine of God's election. The doctrine of Christ's substitutionary atonement for His people. This is the glory that we have to know that it is not our works that save us, but Christ works on our behalf. And so I want you to say, if you're struggling like Tolstoy today, I know I'm preaching now, but I need to because I need to get it in at Sunday. But if you're struggling with fear of death as well, I want you to know the only hope and assurance you have in this life is what Christ Jesus does on your behalf. And you can rest on Him and know for certain that if you're in Him, He can give you that peace where nothing else can. Tolstoy's own personal views added to that lack of assurance. Not only did he create his own personal religion and denied much of the supernatural elements of Scripture, but he did what would have called what caused anyone to lack any assurance. Tolstoy denied the deity of Christ. And once you throw the deity of Christ out there, what do you have to rest upon? And that is the great issue. Tolstoy also developed a radical social anarchist ethic that he based on Jesus' teaching to resist not evil. In other words, we shouldn't try to worry about trying to stomp out evil in this world. We should only work individually to ameliorate the problems of the downtrodden ourselves. So we shouldn't worry about big scale issues. We shouldn't worry about the evils of this world. They're just going to happen. There's nothing we can do about it. The only thing we can do is to try to help people in our direct sphere of influence. There's some wisdom in that, but it's the full level anarchy that he went with it is absolutely wrong. But there's some libertarians today that they would just say, yeah, he's right in line with what we think it should be as well. He wrote, quote, "Happiness is found in living for others," end quote. In 1901, Tolstoy was excommunicated by the Russian Orthodox Church, but he was celebrated around the world for his writings. Now, Dostoevsky was a little bit different. Dostoevsky was one of those pan-Slavs that had come and thought of this kind of beautiful, cultural nation that was going to come together of the Slavic people. And he greatly appreciated this kind of Russian culture that desired and celebrated this Slavic identity. He loved the Russian Orthodox Church, very different than Tolstoy on this, very much more optimistic than Tolstoy as well. And he often wrestled with the perplexing issue of how Russia could preserve the traditions of Orthodoxy while at the same time adjusting to the new challenges that it was facing. Industrialization, scientific positivism, which is just the idea that science is the ultimate answer for all things. The growing agnosticism and atheism that was growing rampant. Societal unrest and subversive revolutionary ideas. Dostoevsky battled with what every single conservative battles with today. How do we maintain the elements that we need to conserve while simultaneously dealing with things that must progress? How do we balance those things? And it's something that we as humans rarely do well at all. And Dostoevsky was very much in line with this. Now, Dostoevsky's concern came from his own maltreatment by the Tsarist police, who falsely accused him of being a socialist revolutionary. He wasn't a socialist revolutionary at all. In many ways, he was a conservative in many ways. And Dostoevsky was a utopian, not in the Marxist sense, but in the conservative sense. He saw a utopia being a beautiful Russian church that was overall, who lived for Christ. And that was his idea, was a millennial utopia, a Christian millennial utopia, post-millennial utopia, one could even argue, not the Marxist utopia that was also being rampant during this period. He was sentenced to death by a firing squad. However, at the very last moment of his life, he was spared by a reprieve, but he was sentenced to 10 years of labor in a prison in Siberia. Now, you can only imagine what intensive labor in Siberia must have been like. Oh, by the way, there was no heat back then. Like central heating systems in those prisons. It was cold. It was detrimental. It was absolutely torture. And it would ultimately impair him to where he would eventually die from that experience. But ultimately, the Tsarist Romanov dynasty was beginning to fade, even though no one knew it. And with that, many religious developments began to happen as well. Many Russians, despite the fact that they were during a period of economic distress, worker strikes, unrest among peasants, did not believe that revolution could actually ever come. We need to wake up to that. They looked at the fact, oh yeah, we know the economy's bad. We know everybody's rioting in the streets, but yeah, they'll get over it eventually. And we can just keep sitting back and not worrying about it because eventually it'll take care of itself. And they would come to realize that was not the case. They saw their conditions as simply the inevitable sufferings of life in any age that eventually people will just get over. Many of the people were also radically anti-revolutionary, primarily because of how bad the French Revolution was. What's amazing is people don't realize, the people who so champion the French Revolution today, don't realize just how bad of a taste it left in the mouth of pretty much all of Europe and Asia at this period. Everyone looked at the French Revolution as the supreme failure of any society. And that was the case. And they didn't think revolution would happen because they thought people were smart enough to see what happens if you try a godless revolution. Fortunately, people don't learn from history. Many sought a religion as the answers, and so many began to become more spiritual, but not orthodox. They began to dabble in these new kind of spiritualistic movements. Kabbalah and Eastern mysticism start becoming huge in Russia. And not only that, but many groups like the occult, Masonic lodges all of a sudden begin to develop all over Russia. And the occult becomes huge. And even the beginning of Satanism begins during this period in Russia. And so it's just fascinating. You have all of these new spiritualist and occultic movements happening because people are trying to find answers in something, but not wanting to go to the orthodoxy, which they've seen has capitulated to the government. Many Russian peasants began to grow in their fascination of supernatural phenomenon. And this was also a time where Protestant missionaries kind of saw themselves as, hey, we got an in here. These people don't like Russian Orthodoxy. And so now's the time to go be missionaries in Russia. And so many Protestant groups began to go into Russia and did quite a bit of work there, even though these separatist groups, as we would call them, were under the repression of the government for the vast majority of their existence. Even today, many of the Russian Protestant groups are under a heavy hand of the government. In 1914, there were actually one specific group really flourished in Russia, and it was the Mennonites. By 1914, there were 100,000 Mennonites in Russia, and many of them had fled from Prussia because Prussia required every man in the country to serve military. They had a mandatory military requirement, and Mennonites are pacifists. So they refused that, so they fled to Russia where they didn't have to serve in the military there. Many of these groups created their own agrarian colonies, maintaining their own schools and churches. However, prior to 1914, Russia began to really kind of push down and press down on these Mennonites, and so they had to flee. And the vast majority of these Mennonite communities came to Canada and America, to primary places like Manitoba and Canada. And the largest area of Mennonite migration into the original migration into the U.S. was Kansas, of all places. So Kansas and Manitoba, Canada were the kind of the first huge in wave of Mennonite immigrants coming out of Russia. These Mennonites, by the way, their principle is unity in essentials, tolerance in non-essentials, moderation in all things. That's pretty much the evangelical creed nowadays. I just want you to say, that's just interesting to me. That began with the Mennonites, and a lot of evangelical churches hold that same creed today. But in all of these religious developments, what led to the downfall, what would cause the Tsarist Romanov dynasty to collapse? And it was ultimately the Russian Revolution and the rise of the communist state. Bloody Sunday happened on January 22nd, 1905. And it shattered any illusions for many that they were living in this kind of politically and socially stable state. Now, I want you to read the official account of this and just let your mind go here. Because to me, when I was reading through this, as I was reading through the primary sources for this lecture, this kind of worry, like this is one of those things you're just kind of like, oh, that sounds weird, and I don't like how familiar that sounds right now. So just, here's the official government account of this. When a crowd of several thousand assembled for rioting and for protesting, Father Gapon there, who led them, and we'll talk about him in a moment, said the prayers, And despite the pleas by the local police officers and the armed cavalry, and who continue to charge and kind of try to push back the crowd peacefully, the crowd refused to disperse, but continued to advance, pushing further and further upon the police lines and the armed cavalry. When the threat of life became apparent for them, two companies of the cavalry opened fire, killing 10 and wounding 20. The cavalry tried to make further charges to try to disperse the crowd, but it refused to have an effect as the men grew violent and more outraged at what had happened. And with this, the companies felt absolutely threatened and dire, in a dire situation. And a number of volleys were then fired into the crowd. In this process of Bloody Sunday, in this one moment, at least 1,000 people were killed, including women and children. So this is happening, this social unrest, this rioting is happening in the streets, people continuing to press forward and forward, the police asking them to turn back, asking them to go away, and unfortunately they fire upon unarmed protesters and people. This event, you can imagine, created a huge hysteria across Russia. It led to strikes breaking out over the entire empire. And what did people do? Peasants torched chateaus and private property in Georgia and the Volga area. These new councils, these new groups that were going around destroying areas, these groups were called the councils, which in Russia is called the Soviets. The Soviets began coming into these cities, torching and destroying property in order to try and show their anger and frustration over what the state had done. And they began making their appearances in Moscow and St. Peter's. And there were numerous reasons that kept adding fuel to the flame of this revolution. Russia lost to Japan in the Japanese-Russian War in 1948. They lost the Crimean War, and then they lose to Japan. And this is becoming a huge issue. They just keep losing in battle. That is their Achilles heel during this period. 80,000 workers went on strike in 1904, demanding better wages and working conditions. And there was a continual class strife that was happening amongst the people, and which was being propagated by these new leaders. Groups like the nihilists and the anarchists and the Marxists began stirring hot fires of rebellion. And in 1895, a man who once was arrested and imprisoned and exiled to Siberia sought to bring leadership to this revolutionary movement. His name was Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, also known as Vladimir Lenin. Lenin organized a group known as the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party with the goal of ending class struggle once and for all. There will be no more class struggle when I rule. It will all be equal. We will all be the same when I'm in power. And he led it with the Marxist goal of seeing the proletariat, that is the lower class, the working class, seize all political power and organize what he saw as the perfect socialist society. This was the goal of Lenin. Now, more to say about him in a second, but I want to talk about the other party. The other party that was leading this kind of revolution, but not for any reason that Lenin did. A man by the name of Father George Gapon. Father George Gapon was neither a socialist revolutionary or anything else, but he was a priest who really emphasized the social gospel. He wanted to address these major social issues that were happening in Russia, but he wanted to do it in a peaceful way. So he's actually the one who organized the demonstration that led to Bloody Sunday. Obviously, he never thought it would turn violent. He never thought the protest would go as bad as it did. He simply was trying to march to the Tsarist home and ask for a petition to be signed, which would meet economic and political demands for the people, and he thought that at least the Tsar would hear them out. He would hear them out. They never thought that they would be fired upon or that it would turn violent and deadly. Father Gapon, in many ways, was a social gospel advocate, as was so common amongst the 19th and 20th century, and saw his ministry as organizing labor unions and other avenues of social work. But he de-emphasized the importance of the church and the importance of the gospel. With that, the Russian Orthodox Church defrocked him, and he actually became an enemy. Not himself, but the Russian Church actually hated him. They saw him as a social revolutionary himself. And in 1906, unfortunately, Father Gapon was found hung by someone. And so, a really sad ending for Father Gapon. But that just goes to show you, these revolutions were started on good principles. They just wanted people to have good working conditions, and they wanted equality, and they wanted justice, right? But it's amazing how radicals can take good protests and turn them into revolutionary movements of destruction. And that's what happened with Lenin and the Bolsheviks. The events of Bloody Sunday and the ensuing chaos and the insurrection deeply troubled Tsar Nicholas. And he tried to restore force to oppress the movement, but he also wanted to give in to some demands. So he oppressed the movement so that it didn't happen any further, which a lot of people hated. But he also tried to give in to some of the demands and say, here's new rights and new freedoms. And a lot of that was actually good. He allowed lower class individuals for the first time to ever be able to participate in state government, in what is known as the Duma, where they were able to meet together, kind of like the Russian Senate. He granted many civil freedoms, including the freedom of religion, which allowed Russian groups, primarily Russian Baptists, which are the largest Russian Protestant group at this period, to begin to flourish. And so it seemed like, okay, well, maybe this will iron itself out. He's settled down the flames, and he's given in to these kind of revolutionaries, and surely they'll go away, right? You'll appease them. The problem is it's very hard to appease revolutionaries. And in spite of all of this, the Tsar was said to not sufficiently address the economic and social grievances. And the resentments began to grow. During the First World War, while they were in battle, the Germans knew that one of their greatest things was to keep Russia out of the fight. And so what did they do? They supported Vladimir Lenin in his coup and in his revolution to take over and overthrow the Russian government. That was the way to keep Russia out of the fight. Germans were very brilliant in that regard there. Didn't work out. They still lost. But they thought it was a good idea. And in tactically speaking, it was. Lenin was a skilled organizer. He knew how to exploit both class grievances and social injustices. He knew how to play on that. And that's what made him so brilliant. And during the Russian Revolution of 1917, he and his Bolshevik colleagues seized power. And Nicholas II was abdicated from the throne. Nicholas II was the last Tsar of Russia. The members of the royal family were all incarcerated. So Nicholas and all of his royal family are taken to prison. And in the early morning of July 17th, 1918, the Tsar was told by the guards that he and his family needed to be moved to another place for safekeeping. They were then subsequently led into the basement of a home by 12 men, and every one of his family members were shot to death by a firing squad of 12 men. Women, his wife, his children, and the family physician were all killed in that. The bodies were then hauled off to a secluded area of the woods. They were soaked in acid and other chemicals and then set in fire in order to try and cover up the hideous crime that had happened. And we know from history now that Lenin personally ordered this execution to happen and all of the details that came with it. Thus, the Romanov dynasty and the last Tsar of Russia had come to an end. Many Russian soldiers tried to fight against Lenin. And those were on the left. Those are known as the White Russian Army. This was kind of the pro-Russia, pro-Tsar movement. And this was the group that was supported by the Russian Orthodox Church, was the White Army of Russia. On the right there is known as the Red Army. And that was the Bolsheviks. That was the revolution. And that was Russia's Red Army. And pretty much every socialist communist movement from there on is known as the Red Army. Mao's Red Army in China and so many others. But this was the civil war that began to take place. Ultimately, the white Russian soldiers were demoralized. They had no really major central leadership. They had no quality, tactful leadership. And more than anything, they just didn't have the morale behind them. Whereas the Bolsheviks, revolutionaries, seeing the time at hand, taking out all of their anger and frustration that they had been kept in for so many years, ultimately won the fight. Nevertheless, it was a loss for Russia in the end, because in this period, in this 5-year period of civil war, in this 25 years of civil war, nearly 25 years, 20 million Russian soldiers lost their life. 20 million soldiers lost their life. Think about that number. 20 million soldiers and civilians lost their life in that period of time. That is unthinkable. We just can't even grasp that kind of number. The Bolsheviks took over in October of 1917, but by 1922 had full power. They had kind of finally crushed out the rest of the White Army. And one of the first things that Lenin did was to remove Russian Orthodoxy as the official state church of Russia. Many in the Russian Orthodox Church tried to stand against him, but it was far too late. Patriarch Tikhon, who was the one of Russia, was thrown in prison, tortured horrifically for opposing Lenin, and was released, but ultimately the torture was so bad that it ultimately led to his death a year or two later. It was not long before the Socialist Revolution turned into full-blown communism, as it does time and time again. And as such, Russia was the first state to have an ideological objective to eliminate religion. It had a goal to eliminate religion, because now it had to unite the people under the power and authority of the government. And any time there is a religious belief that says that there is one higher than the government, that must be killed, that must be crushed. And that was what Lenin and them had to do. They had to remove any concept of Jesus, because if you believe in the Bible and the concept of Jesus, you know that all authority comes from Him. And so they had to crush that, and that's what they went after. The new Soviet Union confiscated church property, they ridiculed religion, they harassed believers, and they propagated atheism in public schools. Not much else to say about that. Priests and believers were variously tortured, they were sent to prison camps, labor camps, and mental hospitals. Many were executed, and between 1917 to 1935, an estimated 95,000 priests were put to death. And the number of Orthodox churches in less than 20 years in Russia fell from over 29,000 churches to less than 500. Though some patriarchs tried to pursue reconciliation with the government, once again, you can't appease a totalitarian dictator. And by the outset of World War II, there were only 4 bishops in Russia. It wasn't until Germany invaded the Soviet Union in 1941 that Stalin had to scale back the campaign of persecution against the church. And though this gave the Russian Orthodox Church a chance to breathe, in 1959, the new communist leader, Nikita Khrushchev, and his successor, Leonid Brezhnev, continued the reign of terror against the church. The most pivotal point of the Russian church history in the past century and a half or so came in 1988, not that long ago, when the Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, introduced a new policy called glasnost, or openness, which ushered in a new period of both governmental transparency and religious freedom. It was also during this period where Ronald Reagan and his famous Mr. Gorbachev tear down this wall. And that all comes down. So it looks like communism is coming to an end. It seems it's all going good. America's won the Cold War. Ronald Reagan's the Messiah. Now, okay, like, this is all the idea, right? He's the greatest president since sliced bread now if you're a Republican. So that's how it all goes. But that's all happening there. It's a huge period for Russian Orthodoxy. This soon released democratic forces throughout Russia. Unfortunately, fortunately, it led to the absolute destruction of the Soviet Union in 1991. But those democratic forces were soon played with and messed with and manipulated once more to where those democratic processes today have led to the multiple election of one Vladimir Putin, who has very much taken the democratic system out of the democracy there. Nevertheless, Russian Orthodoxy has maintained its prominency since 1991 forward. It is a huge aspect of Russian culture still today. I want to close by briefly looking at kind of the Eastern Orthodoxy and the rise of National Orthodoxy. So kind of moving away from Russian Orthodoxy and talking about Eastern Orthodoxy as a whole now. The only thing that really unified the Orthodox Church as a whole in the 19th century was that it absolutely disdained the papacy. I thought the papacy was a totalitarian who kept trying to get Orthodox to convert to Catholicism. That made him so angry. Stop trying to convert our people to Roman Catholic. We don't like you. You think you own everything. They could not stand the Roman papacy. And there was this tension would remain for a long time between Eastern Orthodoxy until the 20th century and the rise of the ecumenical movement, where Eastern Orthodoxy and Roman Catholics pretty much buddied up while still having their disagreement. But one thing that led to this division amongst Orthodoxy was the rise of nationalism, just as it had done in so many other places. And this led to the development of independent national Orthodox churches. The Greek Revolution was launched, and after it, the church established its own ecclesiastical autonomy, whereby in 1850, the Greek Orthodox Church was established. And so now when you see the Greek Orthodox Church like down the road, that was officially made an autonomous branch of Orthodoxy in 1850. In 1879, when the Serbians won their independence from the Turks, something that we still have to go deal with, one of our guard units just came back from Kosovo, where they are still dealing with issues over there in that area between the Bosnians and the Serbs and things like this. So this has happened a long time. But the Serbian church became an autonomous branch of this in 1879. And this continued to happen with Bulgaria and Romania, all of which have been since given their own patriarchates. And so there's this continual growing advancement of national Orthodox churches. So when you say, well, are you Orthodox? Well, people ask, what do you mean? I'm Greek Orthodox, I'm Russian Orthodox, I'm Romanian Orthodox, I'm Serbian Orthodox. So you start seeing this kind of denominationalism taking place within there. The 20th century saw a mass immigration of Eastern Orthodox into America in order to escape persecution and American and experience freedom of religion. And almost all branches of Orthodoxy at this point in America have established a diocese. So there's pretty much every form of Orthodoxy that you can find in America at this point. But what's interesting about it coming to America is before that, almost every Orthodox service was done in Greek. That was kind of their lane, where Rome did it in Latin. The East did it in Greek. When it came to America, they started doing it in English because America makes everything American. And so we make sure we put our stamp on it all. And that's what happened. Their liturgy became predominantly English. So if you go into a Greek Orthodox church today, unless they are straight up traditional, the vast majority of them do their liturgies in English. And some do kind of a hybrid. They'll do the Greek and then they'll do it in English. From the 1920s, Eastern Orthodoxy has played a big part in the modern ecumenical movement, which seeks to establish a narrow definition for what it means to be a Christian. So when you ask what it means to be a Christian in the ecumenical movement, most people would say it just means you need to profess that Jesus is Lord. That would be it. What you say about Jesus, what you mean by Lord, it doesn't really matter. Do you confess Jesus is Lord? The vast majority of the ecumenicism really boiled it down to that. You're a Christian then if you just say Jesus is Lord. And it did this in order to establish greater cooperation and integration among all who refer to themselves as followers of Christ. By the turn of the 21st century, the complex of Orthodox churches of Orthodox church number reached about 210 million adherents worldwide. So there are about 220 million now Orthodox adherents throughout the world. The four major patriarchs of Orthodoxy are Constantinople, Jerusalem, Antioch, and Alexandria. All of them still have ecclesiastical precedence, but the real dominant force of Orthodoxy today is Russian Orthodox. About two-thirds of all Orthodox believers in the world belong to either the Russian or the Romanian Orthodox churches. And so you have a pretty good likelihood if you run across someone who's Orthodox that they're most likely Russian Orthodox. And that's very much the case here in Alaska, especially. Today, Eastern Orthodoxy has actually began to create a bit of a buzz in our culture. And it's drew many young people to it, especially, primarily young men. And the reason why it has kind of created this draw for so many is because it appeals to antiquity. A lot of young men are just trying to we want something real. We want something substantive. The modern church has failed a lot of people, and I totally amen that. I get it. Because I've seen modern churches, and it's just, ugh. I don't even know what you want to call that. But that has put off a lot of young people especially. And they want something real. They want something authentic. They want to feel like they belong to history. And orthodoxy gives them that feeling. They go in this real traditional style worship and liturgy. The guy's wearing his long black cloak. He's got his beard. It feels like, whoa, this thing's getting real in here, right? And so people feel, it feels a little more orthodox. It's nowhere near as much smell, bells and whistles as Roman Catholicism is. So people don't feel like, well, it's not as weird as that. So I can at least have some bit of antiquity. And also, it has a very highly symbolic form of worship. It deals a lot with symbols and signs. And anybody, most young men today, or most of you, most young ladies, have heard of a man by the name of Jordan Peterson. Jordan Peterson is this vast pusher of symbols, archetypes. And so this kind of really grabs the mind of many young men. And so that is what has caused Eastern Orthodoxy to appeal to so many young men. And what used to be what we call the Young Restless Reformed Movement, a lot of those guys have went to Eastern Orthodoxy because of their very shallow roots in biblical orthodoxy, and thus a desire to have something that they feel is more attached to history without thinking about what that means, and they're losing confessionally in the process. So that's the Russian and Eastern Orthodoxy Church up till today. And we may hit it a little bit in passing as we finish up our last couple lectures, but that's where it is today, and an incredible story as we walk through that now since its founding. Let's go ahead and stop there tonight and pray. Father God, a lot of information, but just once again, thankful for this time to study and grow. God, I just pray that we've been faithful with the facts, we've been faithful with truth. We always want to be faithful. We never want to be anachronistic. And so, God, we just ask that we have done so. We ask that you will use this to edify and equip us. We ask that you will be with all of those as they travel home. Keep them safe this week. God, we just can't thank you enough for this amazing weather. And God, we just ask that you would just continue to be with us, be with our families, be with our hearts, and call us to live for Christ in all that we do. Say these things in your precious and holy name. Amen.